because they could not do any magic, even if it meant saving their life. And we'll also refer to one quote of Maimonides in his letter to Marseille, where he talks about astrology and what our view should be in terms of the three categories of accepting what's true, what's not. How are you today?
I'm doing okay, thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cal.
And Sean is with us also.
Sean who?
Sean O'Neill.
Sean O'Neill. How are you doing, Sean?
Good. How about yourself?
Okay, thank God. And due to what you said, Cal, the last time we had the class, I thought we'd review a little bit and maybe go a little bit further in terms of what we're discussing. Okay, so I'll start just by asking if there are any questions or clarifications on what we discussed last time.
And maybe it's a germane question that came up over the week from someone. They were talking about, kind of related to our point about how many of the religions came up because of a revelation to one person, as opposed to the Judaism, where we got the revelation to the entire nation of Israel. This individual said, in the end, you still have to trust one person because Moses wrote the Torah. So how do we know he wrote it right?
Now, what's his argument that we're trusting only one person? And again, is the sound okay today?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. What's his argument that we're trusting one person?
Right.
That was a question. What is his argument?
That was the question. We still, in the end, she said, we still have to just trust one person.
And what is that? I'd like
the. If I understood the argument correctly, she was saying, if you, you know, if you go to this religion, you have to trust that their revelation was right. If you go to that one, you have to trust that their revelation was right. If you go to Judaism, you have to trust that Moses' revelation was correct, and that he wrote it. That he wrote down exactly what God told him to write down.
You mean to
say, I don't think she argued with the fact that 2 million people heard God's voice, but in the end, the Torah itself, she said, was written down by Moses. So we're back to trusting a single individual.
Right, well, this one, his face was shining light, and the people saw it, and they were terrified by it. They looked at it, and they were. I don't know if the correct word is terrified, but the question is, why did God institute this miracle? And again, that was something which everybody saw as well. And it said that he wore a veil when he was not speaking with God. So all the time, subsequent to the receipt of the Torah, Moses, although the paintings don't illustrate this, but he was wearing a veil over his face the whole time. Christians from that point forward. But why do you think God created...
indication to the people that... something very special happened there.
Right. Now, would we say that God would perform a miracle for somebody who's writing something other than what God told him? True, because once he gives the Torah over...
That's a good response.
Right, so it's an endorsement that he was continually upholding exactly what God commanded him to communicate and to write down. Otherwise, God would not endorse such a person with... certainly that the... which is actually related to what I want to bring up today also, is Saul did not follow God's word to kill Agag, who was the king of the Amalek nation. So he was removed immediately from being king. And God sent the prophet Samuel to him, saying that that he's no longer desired by God and is going to get somebody who's going to follow God. So David was anointed subsequent to Saul's great error. And so we see that whenever somebody does not... even veers from one command, because they did kill all the people, but they saved the livestock, and he spared the king. That was Saul's mistakes. So as soon as he veered from God's word to continue as king, Moses himself did not speak to the rock to cause it to bring out water, which would have been a great sanctification of God's name, but he hit the rock instead. And he was not allowed to enter the people into Israel because of that. So we see that God does, the greater distinction is that this is where God revealed himself to anybody. And everything else is based on a person's, you know, one word. So at the very least, the person would have a question, how do we know what he wrote is true? But you can't deny the fact that God gave a Torah, because in subsequent and whatever other miracles took place through him and then through Joshua and all the other leaders. So that's a clear endorsement that they are following what's proper.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Sure. Masses. So therefore, it does come down to just one without any substantiation to the... Now, this is not only something which in the Torah, because you have different sects of Judaism today, and many of them, unfortunately, are following the same exact path based on the proper reason why we believe things. And we give the example of this to be accepted only based on what is reasonable. Today, it's called a letter on astrology. And I'm just going to quote one part of it as follows. Quote, and he's writing, I guess, to the leaders as well, because he starts off by saying, "Know, my masters, that it is not proper for man to accept as trustworthy anything other than one of these three things. Number one, the first is a thing for which there is a clear proof deriving from man's reasoning, such as arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy. Number two, the second is a thing that a man perceives through one of his five senses, such as when he knows with certainty that this is red and this is black, only accept as being true. So the first one is what he derives through his reasoning. A second category that a person should accept as being true is that which he perceives through his senses. And the third thing that a man receives from the prophets or from the righteous." And then he says, "Every reasonable man ought to distinguish in his mind and thought all the things that he accepts as trustworthy and say, quote, this I accept as trustworthy because of tradition, and this because of sense perception, and this on the grounds of reason. Anyone who accepts as trustworthy anything that is not of these three species, of him it is said, quote, the simple believes everything." You see that Maimonides points out that there are three categories: always base it on perception, or because we receive it from the prophets or from the righteous. So in the latter case, the last case, the prophets or the righteous, this means that it's now something, if it's from the prophets, it means that it's something directly communicated by God, and therefore it's the voice of authority, or from the righteous. So when we see people living a righteous way, so we know that they are in line with truth and we can trust them. But even in those cases, the author of Duties of the Hearts states that we should not just leave it at that and just accept it on authority, but then we should also use our own mind to discern that it's true. Because ultimately, we have the capability of reason just like the prophet and just like the righteous. So we should not just abandon it and accept whatever, because even a person like that can make an error. But we can have an initial acceptance of it because there is an authority. So we see...
Right.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, if we took a case like the Civil War, which we didn't get through a prophet, we didn't get through our five senses, but we got through a preponderance of historical evidence, would that fall under what Maimonides is describing as number one?
Through reason, yes. That would fall into the category of number one. Through reason. Because we'd have to use reasoning just as we apply it to Sinai. And once we remove the two possibilities of a historical event being false, like we said last week, either something is false or it's true. So once we've eliminated both possibilities of it's false, either through fabrication, which is a malicious corruption of an account, and we show that there are masses that witnessed it, therefore that removes any fabrication, because fabrication, as Rabbi Chay taught, is something which is motivation. Human motivation is what causes a lie. You cannot have masses all conspiring to lie. It's an impossibility. A few people, yes. So once we remove the possibility of fabrication, the only other possibility left is that maybe the story is erroneous. Maybe there's some sort of ignorance in the communication. But that we can remove when we show that the story itself is, the facts are very easy to comprehend by a normal, average human being. So in terms of the Civil War, the dates, the places, the generals, and the parties that were at war, that is something which is very simple to communicate, and we don't assume that there's any error of miscommunication when the matter is very simple. So yes, that would fall under the first category of reason.
And Rabbi, could you tell me the source once again of that Maimonides letter on astrology?
Yes, Marseille.htm. And Marseille is spelled Marseille. So it's Masora.org/letter2Marseille.htm. And you'll see the entire letter there. I did hear, though, I'm not sure of the source. I'll have to verify myself that there's a dispute on authorship. I'm not sure if that's true or if that, again, is attempts at some people to just knock Maimonides, who uprooted all people's cherished beliefs. I mean, there was a book burning of Maimonides. A great rabbi had apologized later on the mistake. He attests to the truths that were subsequently realized when they looked through Maimonides' work and saw that everything that he was teaching was all based on these three principles, based on perception or based on the authority of a prophet or a righteous individual. And the Torah bears this out in numerous places. I'll cite some sources as we go on. You know, thinking over what we discussed last week, you know, if people tend to feel that they're going to be even more righteous and more religious, and really that even has a base in the ego, that a person wants to feel more satisfied, that, oh, I'm doing even more. But the fact is, God said openly, don't add to the Torah and don't subtract from the Torah. So we see that God had forewarned on this over-religious doctor, and the doctor says, take these 10 pills every day at 5 in the morning and don't add on to them and don't subtract from them. And your person definitely would not be foolish to risk his own life and start saying, well, I think I'll take 9 instead, and I'll do them at 10 o'clock in the morning because I want to sleep an extra hour or whatever. So we see that a person, when it comes according to what we recognize is true, and not to start assuming other things. For example, it says, Machshefa lo sechaya, a witch you should not let live. And we also mentioned this last week. And that's why that person would be killed, whether it's a male or... So the reason is because since man is involved, so that may curb his attention towards other superstitious areas. But not because of astrologers that kept on feigning a certain power. But I think it's important to repeat again the actions in the Torah Yosef had procured by the 7 years of plenty. So Joseph was very successful at taking all the grain and storing it, and it didn't rot. Astrologers or the Egyptians themselves came to Paro and said, we tried to. So Paro said to them, well, and this is, I'm quoting Rashi. So Paro said, well, what happened that the magicians at that point either do some sort of a magic thing that would make all the grain preserved, or one better, why don't they just produce new grain every day during the famine? Why did all the Egyptians have to end up going to Joseph to buy grain? So we see that is a very big question. Evidence of magic work, they were so, if they could really perform magic, why do we see them when it came to this area of the grain that they didn't have the ability? Well, the bottom line is that they had no power. They were only able to do things which came under the category of sleight of hand. When we said that they were able to manipulate or mimic blood, so they changed it red also. They used dyes. As I mentioned, Sadyagon said this is how they did it. Of frogs, so they were also able to make frogs leap out of the water, but that was by using some chemicals that the frogs were allergic to. But when it came to duplicating, that's just too small of a creature for the for fingers to manipulate. So only that which is, there's plenty of proofs to show that that really unveils the lies. And why power accepted them and why the people accepted them is because people have a need. It's people have a psychological need to have things taken care of them. That's why there's another prohibition in the Torah, another one of the 613 commands, is not to go to any fortune tellers that would tell you, do this today and you'll be successful, or do that tomorrow and you'll be successful, or if you do this action, you'll be successful. All these type of addressing human nature. It's addressing the insecurity. And we also mentioned last week that the insecurity comes from the infantile state that we all go through, where we have parents that are so superior to us in that when we grow older, most normal people will be able to abandon that because that's natural. The person will realize, reality will show him that his parents are no more superior than he is, and then he'll abandon that view. But what many people do, unfortunately, is to look for a replacement for the parent because they are still so set in an infantile state of mind. And God even says to the Jewish slave that if he wants to be a slave, and stay with his master? Because a person can, according to Jewish law, sell himself for a number of years if he's really impoverished and he needs to make money, so he'll hire himself out as a slave, but that has to have a term to it. It has to come to an end. Because God says, Avadayhem v'lo avdei avadam, you are my servants and not servants of servants. Meaning your state as a normal, healthy human being is not to be subservient to another human being. Temporarily, yes. But really, you should be looking to God alone. Again, so that that again underscores the concept that a witch or warlock is killed because that obscures God as being the exclusive cause of any power. The only power that a human being has is muscular power. That and no more than that. Need, that psychological need to have somebody telling them what I should do with my life. Should I do something tomorrow? Should I do this business venture today? And you have that in Jewish circles as well, where people, for any single question, they will go to the Rebbe. They will look at him as having an authoritative source in every area. If he has knowledge in the area, yes. And if you're asking him how to reason about a certain thing, should I pick podiatry or dentistry? Well, the Rebbe can definitely help you in terms of thinking through and analyzing the subject matter. But that he's a master in dentistry over podiatry, no, not necessarily. But when people come to the point where they can't free themselves from that psychological crutch of another human being, so then it's going to express itself in many ways. And that's why there are many prohibitions in the Torah which speak against this type of a belief. And it's never been evidenced. It's just belief. And this is where the other religions stumble, is that they're willing to just accept because it satisfies the infantile need. And that's why Christianity was so popular and still is, because it's centers itself around a human figure. So this caters to that infantile need that people just can't free themselves from. They can't extricate themselves from an infantile state which is necessary for a certain amount of time, because this way that ensures the safety and the health of a child when he's dependent on the parent and doesn't run off. He has that need for the parent because it's necessary until he becomes a psychological and physically independent organism and human being. So until that point comes, he is reliant on parents because they know better how to take care of them and what to do when they're sick and how to approach certain issues that the infant just can't. So it has its place, but it's temporary. Also another case, which I'll read you the words, and this is a famous case that people all the time ask, if Judaism doesn't have except witchery and magic, so how come it says, and I'm quoting from, this is Samuel 1, chapter 28:15. And this is when Saul was afraid. He saw that the Philistines were encamping themselves up for war against Saul and the Jews, and he was confused. He was very affrighted, very scared, very terrified, and he called out to God, but God didn't answer him. And this is the first book of Samuel 28:6. Called out to God what he should do, and God didn't answer him, even in the dreams of night, and even by the breastplate which had the prophetic Urim V'Tumim, which was God's name. It was written down and placed in the high priest's breastplate, and that is how communication for a certain period was made between God and the people. And also Saul got no answer from the prophets, so he said to his servant, go seek me out dead, which is called an oath. So they sought her out. Saul approached her, and she said, and he dressed in different clothes, so he's prohibition to have any type of conjurers. So he dressed in different clothing. The woman, when he comes to her, she says to him, do you not know that Saul the king had done, that he wiped out all of the conjurers of the dead from the land? And why are you now threatening my life? Because she's saying, in other words, it'll become popular that I am now practicing this again, and I'll be wiped out as well. So Saul, without revealing who he was, he says, I swear by God's name that you will not get any sin by this. So you see how corrupt Saul was at this point. He's swearing in God's name, but God's the one that said you can't have the oath. You can't have these conjurers. So he was so distraught, he completely distorted the Torah. And she says to him, okay, who do you want me to raise from the dead? So he says, bring up Samuel, because Samuel was the prophet, but he was already dead. But then the woman cries out in a great voice, and he says to her, don't worry, don't be afraid. What did you see, he says, because he heard her shriek. And he says, what did you see? In other words, it made you cry out so loud. Seen coming up from the ground. And he says to her, what is his form? What did he look like? So she said, he's old. It's an old man that's coming up. And he's wearing a me'il, a garment. And then Saul knew at this point that this was Samuel. And he bowed to the ground. And now it says in the verse, this is the verse which is the real perplexing verse. It says that now Samuel said to King Saul, why have you angered me to bring me up? And Saul says, because the Philistines are going to war against us. And God has removed himself from me. And he didn't answer me. And even the prophets have not answered me, and not in dreams. And I've called to you to tell me what's going to happen. All right, so that's all we really need for the story. But it seems from the verse that the woman really successfully brought up Samuel from the dead. So how do we understand this? So it is essential that we have the commentaries, and we refer to, again, we do not just have the written Torah, but there's also the oral Torah. So what he says is as follows. And he says, he said three things on this manner. The one that raises up sees and does not hear. And the one who has the need hears but does not see. And those who have no need neither hear nor see. The person will see but will not hear. And the one that has the need, which was King Saul in this case, because he says afterwards, so also is what is the case here with Samuel. The woman that brought him up saw him but did not hear anything he said. And Saul, I'm reading from Radak, by the way. And Saul, who had the need to speak to the dead Samuel, he heard but did not see him. That's why you see, he says to the woman, what does he look like? Meaning to say, the woman says, I see a man coming up from the dead, and he's old, and he's wearing the garment, the me'il. But Saul says to her, what does he look like? That means he didn't see. So the woman claims to have seen. Saul doesn't see, but then the pasuk, the verse, says that Samuel is talking to him. And then the two who were with Saul at this point, which were Avner and Amasa, they had no need for Samuel either way, so they didn't see anything and they didn't hear anything. What is this teaching us?
Psychological thing on the part of Saul.
Right. And on the part of the woman, the conjurer?
Yeah, she's seeing what she wants to see.
Another possibility?
I wonder how she recognized him as being King Saul, though. Sam, no.
Well, he could have changed his clothing, but you can't change your face. And it could just be also from the fact that he asked for Samuel. Who would be? She just put two and two together. But what's another possibility of why she saw him?
It could be she's just faking it in order to make him a happy client.
Exactly. Exactly like the astrologers of Paro. They would keep on saying things to him. When he had the seven dreams, they said, oh, yes, Paro, you're going to have seven daughters and you're going to bury seven daughters. So they would keep on saying things that could not be disproved, because if he doesn't have them even in a year or two from now, they'll say to him again, yes, you will have them. It just didn't happen yet. So they would always say things that would keep them in their posts. Because evidently they got to that because, I mean, why did these people become magicians and not others? Evidently they came forth to power saying that they wanted the position. That's why politicians and lies go hand in hand. They want the position, so they do not want truth then. What they want is the position, which requires satisfying all the people all the time. And since that is impossible, they have to keep on flip-flopping and changing their positions left and right and lying when they say, I'm going to do this last year. Well, you know, I really meant I'm going to do the opposite. So the same thing here. So what the Radak is saying is that the woman who wanted to fame, she said, oh, yeah, I see him. But in terms of any communication, she can't start making up information, because then that'll expose her as being false. She has no idea what Samuel would say. So she says, oh, yeah, I see him. And because she puts two and two together, she sees that Saul is the one that's here now. He's the one that's in need. And so he must be that who died recently that he must be concerned about. So that's not too far of a stretch for her to figure it out.
The sort of mystique of these people that they can see but others cannot. So he wouldn't have expected to see.
Okay. But why did he hear?
Heard what she was telling him.
Right. So it must have been either that's more plausible, that she was making some sort of a very deep voice, like a ventriloquist, which is what they did. And it's called someone who brings up a voice, do it in a funny way, like from the armpit or someplace close to the mouth, but from like a part of the body that they would claim it's coming from. So they couldn't do it like from their foot because it's too far away. You can't throw your voice that far. So just the symptoms themselves that we learn about these different conjurers and how they performed exposes their limitation on, you know, what they could fake. So yes, so she was most probably just making a voice very deep, not moving her lips, and then he heard. But he couldn't see because there wasn't anything there. And the two people that were with his officers, that were with Saul, they didn't see anything and they didn't hear anything because they had no need. There was no need whatsoever, so psychologically there was nothing there. The actual words of the Radak, though, seem to imply that she didn't make a voice. Had she made a voice, even the two people that were with Saul would have heard it. So it must be that maybe he just had such a need, he thought he heard somebody. And many times, a person feels that somebody just called his name. When he's in the room and there's a lot of people talking or so on, he might feel that his name is being called only because he wants to be recognized. But the sense of perception is so clear that a person can't lie to himself and says that he sees something if it's not there. But in terms of there's enough like noise going around, a person might feel that he heard his name. So you see here clearly the Torah does not accept any of these things. I mean, brief but salient from Ibn Ezra. Right, this very prohibition. Do not turn to the Ovos. Do not turn, meaning don't go after those that bring up the dead. Or the Adonim. These are people that put a bone of a certain bird in their mouth and make sounds. And don't inquire to impurify yourself with them. And then the verse ends, I am God, your God. I am God, meaning I'm the only one that can make. Ibn Ezra says on this verse, quote, empty-brained people state that were not for the fact that the conjurers of magic were actual truths, the Torah would not have prohibited it. But I, Ibn Ezra, I say just the opposite of their words. For the Torah does not command against truth, only against what's false. And the proof is the Torah's prohibitions against idols. End quote. Again, empty-brained people state that were it not for the fact that the conjurers and magic were actual truths, the Torah would not have prohibited it. But I say just the opposite of their words. For the Torah does not command against truth, but only against what is false. And the proof is the idols. So Ibn Ezra calls people who accept this, meaning the Torah, I heard Jews say this, that well, the reason why the Torah prohibits against going to these warlocks and witches and all because it's true, but it's to show our faith in God. But Ibn Ezra says just the opposite. No, these things are false. There are no proof to them. And the reason why there's a prohibition is because they're false. God only tells you not to follow which is not based in reality. God would not tell you not to follow something which is true. That's what Ibn Ezra says. The Torah does not command against truth, only against what is false. And then he says, the proof is idols. Now, what does that last statement mean? And the proof is idols.
They're prohibited and they're clearly false.
Right. Why do you think he uses idols as opposed to any other type of idolatrous practice? Where people may worship the sun, the moon, the stars, the sea, whatever it is. He says, no, the proof is idols. How is an idol different than every other idolatrous practice?
Because it's clearly made by man?
Exactly. I'm going to start asking you to give the class, Doug. You're too fast. Exactly. Meaning, that is something which is clearly made by man. And what's the next step, Doug? I'm putting you on the spot now.
Well, it's clearly made by man and clearly destroyed by man.
Right.
A man puts his power into something that he created. or gives away his power to something that he created.
Why is this the proof that Ibn Ezra brings that the Torah only commands against what is false? And he says the proof is idols. How is that a proof that this is false? How are idols a proof that the Torah commands against what's false and it uses idols? Let's just bring it to a head.
Well, because sort of the main point of the Torah is to eliminate idolatry, and the commandments around that are so very clear.
Right.
Recognizing that everything comes from God, that He is the Creator.
Okay, but again, you're saying that because it's man-made. The other things, like the worship of the sun or trees or the heavens and the constellations, it's not man-made. But the idol is a man-made by definition. It's a form that's carved out or molded in metal. Because this shows you that, like you're saying, Cal, man is now, he's creating it himself. So the thing wouldn't even exist without man.
But so nothing else would exist without God.
Right, but the point that he's trying to make here is to show you how the Torah commands against falsehoods, and he cites idols as being the example par excellence that the Torah commands against falsehood. Because this thing was nothing. It was just a trunk of a tree, and now you carved it into an idol? Meaning this itself is where it clearly was nothing. And you now actually created the very thing itself. It's completely under your hand. And yet you're going to project powers onto it? But the thing was dependent upon you. See, other things are not dependent upon man. They existed before man existed, the heavens and so on and so forth. But the idol is something which he made with his own hand. And that, more than anything else, should lend itself to man's ridicule, not subservience. So the point is that which man brings into existence, it's dependent upon man, so that, more than anything else, you shouldn't project anything onto. It's dependent upon you, and that you're going to depend on it, you're in a contradiction. He's trying to point out that you gave this thing its existence. So how could you turn 180 and now say that it is now it is responsible for your existence and your good fortune? So that's why I believe he brings idols.
Tell me what the next step was there that I missed.
Just because you were saying that it's man-made. Unless you were saying this, you may have meant it and you just didn't verbalize it. But once you say that it's man-made, now the next step is, so man gave it existence. That's the next step. The next step is, you're right, you keyed right in on the very point that it is man-made and everything else is not. But now let's take it to the climax and show them what does that mean that it's man-made? In terms of our discussion of what man should serve, why should an idol be the worst thing, the last thing he should serve? So we just have to keep it in the context of what is the thing which deserves the greatest ridicule when man worships it? It should be that which man created. Because that he sees with his own two eyes that he made it himself. Nice. Very few words, Ibn Ezra, but very potent. And the Radak actually says, just one more quote from him that we were just reading about Saul. He says, quote, "Although the implications of the words of the rabbis, blessed be the memory, indicate from the Talmud that the idolatrous woman resurrected Samuel, we do not accept these words when our intelligence tells us the opposite." Again, although the implications of the words of the rabbis, blessed be the memory, indicate from the Talmud that the idolatrous woman resurrected Samuel, we do not accept these words when our intelligence tells us the opposite. So he's not saying the rabbis are wrong, he's saying we don't accept the implication. And even if some rabbi would say that it was true, so he clearly rejects it. He said, when our intelligence tells us the opposite, we do not follow words, even if the rabbis wrote them, because what trumps everything else is our own thinking. Okay. But you could ask a very powerful question now. And that would be, why does the Torah write it as if it actually took place? Because the clear words state in the verse that Samuel spoke to Saul. That's clearly what it says.
It's to demonstrate to us how even someone as great as Saul could be vulnerable to such things.
Okay. Well, I mean, that doesn't have to be, that's not necessary, though, to write it, that it sounds like it's a literal thing. So you could have written it in a way where King Saul thought that he saw Samuel, and we'd still get the lesson you want to teach. You could have put the words in the verse, and King Saul thought that he saw Samuel. So that would get out of the problem of it sounding literal, and it also teach a lesson, like you're saying, that even great people can succumb to sin. It doesn't say that. It says that Samuel spoke to Saul, and he has a conversation with him.
Would that be alluding to how powerful our emotions are?
Exactly. Exactly what I was thinking. Meaning the verse is describing this as if it really took place to embody that very strong emotion, to show you how real it could be to a person. It uses the very lesson that the Torah is trying to bring out over here is what it embodies. It says similarly by King Solomon that he served other gods. I'm just paraphrasing. So the Talmud says, no, he didn't serve other gods, but it attributes it as if he did, because he didn't stop his wives from that involvement of idolatry. So it's attributed to him, since he allowed it to happen. So the Torah will verbalize something in a manner in order to drive a point, but we have to understand how to understand the words. The person's dead, that's it. And another person has no power to revive somebody. We can't revive ourselves. I mean, would we revive somebody else? That's what I believe. It's embodying the very point you made, Cal, that it's such a strong emotion. It wanted to embody the realism that Saul perceived at that moment, because he was so desperate. So the Torah puts it down as if it really took place. The rabbis right in the spot and say, no, it's impossible. See, the problem is with a lot of these stories and all these powers and what people are seeking today, it goes back to the infantile state, and it just keeps on popping up, that people just have that very strong infantile need. It's a lot easier to give into it than to use the mind to recognize that it's just not true. Because, again, the emotions do have a head start. We have the emotions working on us since the day that we were born. Intellect doesn't come into the picture until we're into our teens. And even then, if a person's not trained properly, he's not critically thinking. And that state of independence is something which is difficult for people, because that's coupled with the emotion that we're very, very social individuals. And we have a need for others. And that what's dragged along with the need for friendship, which is a good thing, is the need for approval. Because many friendships, if not most, are based on needing the approval of the other friend. It's not just really for a friendship in the right type of a framework, which is to live life together and to learn things together and to help each other out in a real practical, true way. But many, many relationships are based on just a need to substantiate me as being good. That's why people will say one thing to a person in front of them, but behind the back they say something else. They lie in the face of a certain person because they don't want to lose, any friends at all. And they're afraid that they may be ridiculed if the friend finds out what they said about them. So they want to keep the friendship. But at the same time, the very emotion, actually I'll pose this as a question and you tell me why. Why is it that a person will be two-faced? That in front of the friend, they'll talk about the, nice things, how they liked them, this and that. Behind the back, they'll stab them in the back. Why is that? What is the phenomena that causes both of those activities? Why in front of a peer or a friend you'll be so nice and everything, and behind their back is when you'll stab them in the back?
Is it that need to be accepted? Because with that friend, you want to be accepted by them, but then when you're with another group of people or something, you want to feel important in that other in the other group or something, so then you'll turn and say something different about that other person.
Exactly. The same emotion of ego. I mean, the same need for approval. So in front of that friend, you'll be nice. Everything's good. So this way you keep that friendship. You keep your approval there. But when you're with other friends, you can put the other people down. They're not with your group right now, because this is another method by which I can elevate myself.
Mike, can I go back a little bit just for clarification?
Sure, go ahead.
You were talking about idolatry with physical idols versus someone who worships the sun and the moon. Are you talking about degrees there, in a sense? Like the physical idol that man created is worse than someone who would worship the sun and the moon?
I would say that, yes, based on the Ibn Ezra's words, false. You know, what is the level of falsehood that certain things have? So, yes, degrees, something that he's not responsible for. So then it's out of his control, so he might deify it more. But in terms of what he makes with his own hands, that should be the first thing that he rejects. In terms of what would be punishable by the Torah, I can't answer that at this point. I don't know. What would be a greater sin? I don't know if either one, in terms of corruption and thinking, yet there's a greater corruption in thinking when a person creates something with his own hands and he worships it.
Okay, thank you.
He's telling the Jews that don't forget what your eyes saw regarding Sinai. Belief was never part of the picture because belief does not have any type of validation for anything. So he wanted to make sure the Jews were committed to a life of the principles that they followed were all reasonable, and that your acceptance of the system is because of an event that you saw yourself. It's not something coerced or mandated. It's not a dogma. It is something which it was an event. You witnessed the event. Don't forget the event. That's all there is to it. You cannot deny what actually took place. So everywhere we turn, what we see is a constant message from the Torah of using our argument, what's true, or sense perceptions, or what is received from the prophets or the righteous. If something is not arrived at through one of these three areas, then there's no basis to accept it. So it's good to have these three in our pocket, because we could always use the author of Duties of the Heart says it still has to culminate in your own examination and your own self-realization about the truth of something, even if you get it from an authority. But it should not end there, and that's based on the verse in Deuteronomy. You should know a matter today, and then you should place it on your heart. Meaning you could know it, obtain the information from the leaders, from the teachers, but then place it on your heart. Make sure, stop asking until it is. His role is really to make certain that the student sees an idea clear. That's pretty much what I wanted to, you know, just to present, just in terms of a follow-up today as to what we discussed last week. I guess what we see from this is that there are basic rules of thought, and then there's also the other area, which is the emotions. How we have to constantly be on guard to be addressing both parts of our dual nature, our intellect and our emotions. Our intellect has to constantly be refined, and our argumentation has to intelligence alone. At the same time, we have to constantly be on guard against certain emotions. And Doug, the book that you had written was very good in that respect, in terms of, in many respects, but since we're talking about this topic, about you really picked up very well in a very brief manner, the different emotions that come out, and that then you can isolate it, then you could see what exactly the emotion was. And it's, you know, it takes time to do that. There was a lot of good feedback when we ran those articles those two times.
It's almost completed, and I just have to go through final edits and then get busy trying to find a publisher.
Really? I was kidding. I didn't even know you were writing one.
No, I have been working on it for a very long time.
Wow. Excellent.
It's more a full-length book version that organizes some of these ideas in a more orderly fashion.
There you go. You'll have a lot of people that will be interested, so you let me know once you have it out.
Okay, definitely will.
Yeah. All right, so any questions? That was pretty much what I wanted to bring up today.
None here. Thank you, Rabbi. That was very helpful.
Okay, good. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so you want to resume next week with Isaiah pick up, or is there something?
I think Isaiah is fine.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll pick up from there. So that means we're starting the beginning of chapter 2 in Isaiah next Sunday.
Okay.
All right.
All right, excellent. All right, so good day to everybody then.
You have a great week, Rabbi. Thanks.
Okay, be well, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.